Jeremy Meeks.
I'm K. Edward Copeland.
I'm David Helm.
And this is Preacher's Talk, a podcast for preachers and those who love preaching. This podcast is brought to you by Nine Marks Simeon Trust, helping healthy churches get formed. Helping.
You're always freaking preachers. Out on these lines.
Yep. No.
You got to get this a little cleaner.
I can get it as clean as I want. You got the
organization, but it needs to get clean. Something like, you know, establishing healthy churches, training people to handle the Bible.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you got to get good. Go ahead. You were running that thing around like a like a dog on a big long leash.
Welcome to Preacher's Talk. You know who it's brought to you by. If you want to give feedback like Dave's giving me feedback, you can write me at feedback@preacherstalk.org. Oh, man. All right. We are going to talk about context. We've done a few episodes on context. We talked about literary context, mm-hmm. before and after your passage in the same book. We talked about historical context, the situation of the author and the audience. This week, we're going to talk about cultural context.
Good.
So, Dave, what's cultural context?
Okay. Cultural context. I'm going to put it this way. You help me out. Details in the text,
yeah.
that are sufficiently known and understood by the characters in the text, mm-hmm. but not necessarily known or understood by the first readers of the text or the people to whom I'm preaching. Mm. So it's stuff in the text that if you were in that moment, in that scene, you knew what was going on, but not necessarily if you're reading about it, right. or listening to somebody preach about it.
That's good.
It's interesting because the Bible actually will engage in cultural context, right? Not like yeah. actually like pointing it out. So I'm thinking like there's this interesting yeah. thing in 1 Samuel chapter 2, right? Where it talks about Eli's worthless sons. And one of the things that it points out in like chapter 2, verses 12 to 14, is that like the explanation of how they were worthless was about how they would take this pronged fork and stick it into a pot. And he's like, okay, so here, and the reason why it was bad was because they were like supposed to take the fat and offer it to the Lord. They're like, nah, keep the fat on there, which I understand because fat makes it flavorful, but that's not what they were supposed to be doing, right?
You're a New Testament guy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a New Testament guy. Or even New Testament, it does this. Like in Mark chapter 7, where Mark is explaining why there's this beef about whether or not the disciples are washing their hands and why it's not happening. And Mark kind of just takes them and goes, now here's the thing. They had this tradition of washing mm-hmm. all of their stuff. So they're explaining, Mark's assuming that yep. his readers don't understand exactly what's going on.
Right.
Our readers don't understand all kinds of stuff that's going on in the text. And so we're just trying to help them. Because a lot of times, like a first audience would understand. So the author's just assuming that knowledge. And we're coming along and trying to be helpful. Like, hey, this is why this thing that he's saying is so significant.
It's good.
So here's a question, Ed. Where do we learn about the cultural context? Like sometimes, 1 Samuel 2, Mark 7, it's going to point it out for us. But a lot of times, it's just not going to do that. So where are we going to learn about that stuff?
When it's not within the text, as the ones you just pointed out and others that we could point to, sometimes that's where a good resource like Manners and Customs of the Bible or mm-hmm. some type of encyclopedia that helps you understand how things were done or how people lived in that particular time can be helpful.
Yeah. Good. Dave, you got anything to add to that?
No. So yeah, you've got all kinds of early material, Jewish material that would be commentating in a sense on the right. customs of the day. And you've also got some guys that studied under guys like F.F. Bruce. I remember one of my professors, J. Julius Scott Jr. I mean, he centered on all this stuff, all the intertestamental stuff that was going on that these readers, at least in the early New Testament, would have been aware of that we weren't necessarily aware of.
Yeah.
I think more commonly people turn up things like Bible dictionaries.
Right.
They read introductions to books. Mm-hmm. I think they find cultural stuff in introductions to books because there's usually a part of the commentary they're talking about, like, well, what about the times of this book?
Right.
So. Yep. People are borrowing from that kind of material as well.
Right. Now, Ed, how does cultural context sometimes go off the rails in preaching?
If you're a Bible nerd, you can get so caught up in this sort of interesting examination of the milieu that the text comes out of,
yeah,
that you completely miss the point or the thrust of what the author is trying to get at. There is, yeah, a way. And I believe it seems like Dave talked about this in one of the other contextual talks we had, where
if historical.
Yeah, historical, yeah, where you're talking about if you write a letter, right, from Chicago telling, right, me that you're tired or whatever, we can talk about everything about Hyde Park and everything about how things were done in Chicago and miss the point,
yeah,
the thrust that the author is aiming at. So it is possible to go off the rails by being a Bible nerd and just getting so caught up in trying to explain what was happening around the text that you don't see how the only point of using cultural context is how is it going to help me, right, further my argument?
Yeah. In one sense, one of my mentors, Kent Hughes, who we all love and, yep, appreciate, talked about lenses, mm, through which we read the Bible.
Right.
We all have a theological lens, and that can be helpful, but we can begin misinterpreting the scriptures because we're, yeah, reading it through that lens.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same thing here in cultural context. We can be reading our passage through the lens of a purported cultural understanding,
mm-hmm,
that actually was not at all significant in regard to what is being written, how it's being written, or to your point earlier, why it's actually being written.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we end up preaching the cultural context and not the text.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And starting to make, what do you call this? Imposing certain,
yep,
thoughts or intentions or imaginations. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he probably was thinking this, right, when he wrote that, whatever. When
I got a word, let's go, impositional preaching.
There you go.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
Right. Yeah.
We've all done it. I'm, yeah, not saying, sure, it's the other guy.
I mean, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've all come off the rails on this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In the most like sinister versions of this, it's like, I know the text says, mm, but because we know this other thing, then really what's going on here?
Yeah.
You're like, uh-oh. Now we're preaching what's not there, right? Or re-preaching.
Which gets back, by way of reiteration, to your original question of, you know, not only where we get off the rails, but where do we find it?
Mm-hmm.
I do think we find the details in the text, known by those in the text, within the text.
Yep.
Rather than having to rely on all these outside resources. So maybe that would be a help. Read your book for the cultural contextual clues that are emerging within the material itself,
yep,
as opposed to borrowing from all these other things, which then tend to overplay our hand in the preaching.
Yep. At least those are the things that we can be the most sure about.
That's right.
Right. Because there are, like, we want to totally give credence to the fact that, like, there's people who've given their lives to understanding the cultures and times of the people in the text, and that those things can be beneficial. I think the other thing that often happens where preaching goes off the rails is that guys get up there and just, like, essentially want to look smart.
Yeah.
Right? Like, look at all this stuff that I read this week, right? And it's really kind of a form of, like, public Gnosticism, where it's like, hey, look, you didn't know this.
Right.
But I'm telling you, people are just like, that, my preacher is a genius, right? And all it's like is like, well, no, he just knows how to give a book report. Like, that's what,
well,
it is.
And a lot of guys that go into ministry love history.
Yeah.
And they read history. But then all of a sudden you're like, well, I can't really preach Romans well unless I know all my Roman history. You know, you can, but because we're lovers of books, because, yeah, we're historians by nature,
sure,
sometimes that gets in our way.
Yep.
That's true.
So, okay. So now we've talked about pitfalls. So let's talk about the ways in which we're going to talk about examples from our own preaching in a minute. But first, I just want to talk broad level. What can be the real help of delving into cultural context in a sermon, Dave?
Well, I think it can inform my listener. So there's an educational aspect,
yep,
where you need to know this. And the information, though, is needed so that the misreading doesn't come.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example. So John 4:7, you know, he's got the little print, or 4:9, he's got the little parentheses, you know, for Jews did not speak to Samaritans. Comes right on the heels of Jesus saying, woman, give me a drink.
Right.
And then he adds that little thing for his reader. He's aware of how she would have felt about that line.
Yep.
Jesus was aware how he felt about delivering that line, but the writer was aware that his reader wouldn't know what to do with that line.
Yep.
So he adds a parenthesis,
right,
that says, now they didn't do that.
Yep.
Or they weren't on speaking terms. That's massively important. And I'll give you the benefit here for that cultural contextual clue there is for my non-believing listener or for the person who's ensconced in our culture, for a man to say to a woman, give me a drink that's patriarchal.
Right.
That's misogynistic.
Yep.
That's everything that we disdain. But the fact that you actually have to know that piece, that it actually was just the opposite. He was engaging someone that in their context he wouldn't have engaged, that he was doing a loving thing. He was treating her as a human being thing, not as an object thing.
Right.
That's massively important. So the upside is I'm educated, I'm informed by use of cultural context. But the real upside of it is my listener might find the Christian message more plausible than they would have thought had I not actually helped them with that contextual piece.
Yeah, good.
So there's something you said there. Everything you said was great. I think that what cultural context helps us to do is it keeps us from reading into the text our own culture.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
So going back to John chapter 2 about, you know, the wedding at Cana, and there's two things in there. So there's a cultural context in terms of John explaining what those pots were there for.
Yep.
But then we have to do a little bit of work on how did they do weddings back in that day for the whole thing to even make sense.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
So it's a way, because if you don't do that, if you don't add some sort of texture or some sort of depth or instruction about how they lived life and how they conducted weddings, you're thinking about our weddings when you come to the wedding at Cana, and it's a completely different setup.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. This is just another way of talking about what you guys have said. I'm always thinking about the benefit in the kind of informing our text from cultural context is that it really kind of enriches and enlivens what's going on here.
So those are great words.
It could make it significantly more problematic what's happening, or significantly more understandable.
Yeah.
But it always should have some kind of function. So every time we deal with students in Chicago course all the time, and it's like, okay, you've demonstrated that there is some kind of thing here culturally that we need to highlight. Now, what's the function of bringing that up in preaching? And a lot of times it's to see it is one thing, but then to know how you're going to kind of utilize that thing in the preaching is something completely different. Because it can have a lot of different kinds of functions, as we've kind of even discussed with these.
But your words are really good. I wish I'd come up with your words. My words were like instruct, right? Yeah. Your words were enrich.
Yes.
That's very different.
Yeah.
And that would even help me in what am I think I'm doing with it? Enliven.
Yeah.
Is very different than, you know, how is it an asset to understanding?
Right.
Those are great words. I like that.
Okay, so I can imagine the listener out there going like, well, this sounds cool. I've seen a couple examples in the text, some little small examples, but I want to just, like we tend to do, we're going to go around the horn, and Dave, we're going to start with you, and just talk about some recent sermons we've preached and how the utilization of cultural context has been a help, not to preach the whole sermon, but in part of the sermon to help enrich and enliven our preaching.
So yeah. Dave, all right. So I just preached Jonah 1. And in verse 2, the word of the Lord came to Jonah saying, quote, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for its evil has come up before me. Now, the central character in the text is here, Jonah. But there's something known by Jonah that's not known by us in the text. And it's even that word Nineveh. There's a detail in the text, Nineveh, that would have had certain cultural connotation for him that my listener might not necessarily have.
Yep.
And so now what do you do with that? Well, now I get a chance to explain Nineveh on a cultural level to Jonah, to my contemporary listener.
Okay.
And so what it is Nineveh was the capital city of Assyria. That's a fact. But they would have been Israel's then neighbor to the north, and if not their arch enemy at this point in history, certainly their greatest threat nationalistically. So they're a national threat. They're more, in my opinion, they're more outsiders than they are enemies. Because you don't have the ministry of Isaiah yet. You don't know yet in Jonah's ministry that Assyria is going to run over the northern tribes. So you can't bring all that into play.
Right.
You can't bring later biblical mm-hmm. history into play, but you can say these are outsiders. Now, what makes it interesting for the listener, though, is if they're outsiders and they're not God's people and they're a nationalistic threat, it's really interesting that Jonah doesn't go.
Yeah.
Because it says, go and cry out against it, for their evil has come up against me. So the problem is there. Now, you're going to do two things as a preacher then. You're either going to answer the problem, point them to chapter 4, tell them psychologically why Jonah didn't go, or you're actually going to limit your reach there to hold that tension. We don't know. It's strange that he doesn't go. It's inconceivable that he wouldn't go, unless he was afraid for himself going to your nationalistic enemy. I don't think I did it very well in the sermon, but there was a detail in the text that Jonah knew that my listeners would not. And I had to deal somehow with that in ways that hopefully would enrich, but not then just give the whole book away.
Right. And that wasn't what your whole sermon was about.
No, it wasn't. But so it was a detail.
It's a detail, but it actually helps make sense of the story, and it helps kind of problematize the passage going forward. Great. Helpful little thing. Ed, you're coming from a very different text.
Okay, so I'm going to come from Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 all the way to the end of that chapter, which ends at verse 22. You know, Paul's explanation to the Gentiles in that particular congregation, what Christ has done. Mm. And one of the things he says in verse 14 is that he himself is our peace, who made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility. So the dividing wall, what did that mean?
And sounds like a metaphor.
Yeah, it sounds like a metaphor. Right.
It literally sounds like a metaphor, unless you do a little homework. And this is strange. So this is where something that Dave said is important, that within the text itself, sometimes there's sufficient information. Now, if you've read your Bible, you would know that the reason that Paul originally got arrested was he was accused of taking Trophimus, the Ephesian, past the dividing wall that kept the court of the Gentiles from the other courts. And so now for Paul.
In the temple, right?
In the temple, within the temple. So it's temple talk.
Yeah.
There's actually
an insider-outsider.
Insider-outsider. Yep. So now all of a sudden, it's not just a sort of beautiful metaphor. It's an actual tangible thing that really relates to even Paul's imprisonment that speaks to. So it adds not only clarity, but it adds, for lack of a better word, it adds more pixels to the picture.
Yep.
Because now I can point out that within the context of the argument he's making, that Christ not only has reconciled us to God, but he's made one new humanity.
Right.
And he's done that by breaking down something that separated us. Now, all of a sudden, it's not just a pretty metaphor. It's something that is alive.
Right.
And something that is richer to my understanding, and more importantly, to his argument. And now I get to make a better argument. And now it gives me a little more leverage. It gives me a few more anchors, even in my preaching, to think about illustrations.
Yeah.
Because I can think about what contemporarily do we have that functions like that dividing wall did back then, and how is Christ breaking that down, or how has he broken that down in our current situation?
Yeah.
And okay, let's just think of it currently. I love that illustration because, you know, we're all Chicago guys here. So you think about the race issues in this country.
Right.
We normally go to the dividing wall on race issues, particularly black, white. Mm-hmm. But according to you, according to the text, the black and white are both on the outside of that wall.
Right.
So all of a sudden, the value out of the sermon is, why are we building walls between us when we both already know he gave us inside access to his fellowship?
That's right.
So it almost makes our wars look ridiculous.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
We don't know who we are.
Yep.
We should be rushing together into the presence of God.
That's it.
Right, because that's what we actually are, as Paul's explaining there. So it's a super subversive thing, right? Yeah, I'm in prison for doing this thing. Hey, guess what? Christ already teared that thing down. I might be here, but Christ already tore it down. And then he ends it by being like, you all are being built into the temple.
Exactly.
Forget that building, right?
Exactly.
A new building program.
New building program. There you go. Yeah. All right. So again, like it's not the entirety of your sermon, but man, does it start to make some sense.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that thing does function as a metaphor, right? Like if all it was a metaphor, that'd be a helpful metaphor.
Yeah.
So you're able to take that thing and then take it like essentially down a notch and be like, no, it's way more profound than you could imagine.
Right.
Because of what he's actually talking about. That's great.
It's enriching and enlivening.
That's there it. You go.
What do you got?
So I'm going to go with one of the...
What are you bringing to the table?
I'm going
to
go with one of the... I just preached this the other day in Chicago course. One of the ugliest texts in Genesis. So Genesis 38, right? Judah and Tamar. Judah.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like this is something... Like I one time heard an elder of a church tell another pastor, like, you shouldn't read that in church, right, much less preach it.
Wow.
Because it's some ugly stuff, right? And the cultural context comes into play in particular, like cultural context is all over in this passage to really kind of make sense of what's going on because it's so confusing. Because Judah, first of all, gives his first son, like we could just go like at the very top, Judah marries a Canaanite, right?
Right.
And right. You go, oh, okay, that's cool, thank you. But when you hear earlier in Genesis, Judah's dad go, hey, Judah's grandpa told his dad, do not marry a Canaanite. And Judah's dad listened, and now Judah's married a Canaanite. So before the story even gets started, you go, this is heading off the rails. But then Judah has three sons, and you go, okay, it seems like everything's going fine. Except the first son, is incredibly wicked, and God kills him. That word for wickedness comes up in two places in Genesis, two real, not pretty places. You got the people before the flood, and you have two little towns called Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh. So you're like whatever wickedness is, yeah, okay. But it makes sense of like why God might kill this guy, right? And then you have the most messed up thing in the world, at least to us. This gets back to your thing, Dave, where sometimes you're just like, it seems so radically offensive. God kills this wicked man. Judah comes along and goes to Onan, and says, hey, Onan, go be with your brother's wife and produce children by her. Now, anybody hearing that today is going to go like, what are you talking about?
Right.
But the understanding of what we would kind of commonly call Levirate marriage,
yep,
which is then codified later on, but what all of the first readers would have understood, you go, oh, this is just the practice in the ancient Near East of, and it's even clear here in the text, of securing inheritance.
That's it.
And it's securing inheritance not only for Judah, but also for Tamar and all this stuff. So it's like, yeah, go produce. And then Onan explicitly goes, oh, I'll have sex with you, but I won't impregnate you because he wants the inheritance. So what it does in this case isn't make sense of it beginning part of Genesis 38. It doesn't enrich it in a beautiful way. It enriches it in a dark way because this text won't actually play off as far as the light until you get to the very end and you see who the two kids are that Tamar has from Judah. But the benefit of it at the beginning of the sermon is it makes something dark far darker,
yeah,
so that the payoff at the end,
right,
is so much greater.
And Tamar rises because you've got this wickedness,
yep,
this unrighteousness, and eventually Tamar or Judah is going to have to say to Tamar, you're more righteous.
You're more righteous.
You're more righteous than I.
And so, yeah, so the cultural contextual piece on levirate marriage emphasizes their inability or unwillingness,
right,
to live according to God's word.
Right.
Whereas her persistence,
yep,
is that God's word actually needs to be maintained in this family.
Yeah. So
wow.
So you get something like incredibly profound, but what's interesting is cultural context won't always make sense of it in a way that's like, oh, now that's palatable.
Yeah, sometimes, no, that's right.
Sometimes you go, oh, now it's less palatable.
Right.
Okay, but now you better pay off on that in the sermon, right?
Right.
By essentially just preaching the text. But this is how these cultural context, little kind of just details in the text, can enrich our preaching to a great degree. So may we pay attention to the cultural context, not just to give information.
No.
Right? But to drive those sermons forward.
Yeah, and to help the non-Christian find our message more plausible.
Right.
Yeah.
And to give the Christian confidence.
Point. Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah, the Christian's going to get something too.
For more articles, books, and podcasts, please visit 9marks.org.